Warning, this podcast may contain graphic violence, sexual themes, and bad language. If our language offends you, we apologize, but we do not give a fuck. Be mindful of your kids listening.
The Evil Never Dies Podcast.
Welcome to the Evil Never Dies midweek episode. I'm your host for this show, Carl Todd. Tonight, I'm going to cover the Guns N' Roses album, Appetite for Destruction. I'm sure a lot of people are pretty familiar with this album, but I'm going to give a little bit of a background of how Guns N' Roses even got to Appetite for Destruction. There's a lot of stories, and I'm going to try to get the truth out. How did Guns N' Roses become the biggest band in the world, which they were for several years? They were initially formed in 1985, but how did we get to that point? Well, we're going to go with the actual formation and history going back to the band Hollywood Rose. And their rhythm guitar player, whose name was Izzy Stradlin, was living with LA Guns guitar player Tracy Guns. LA Guns needed a new lead vocalist, so Izzy suggested Hollywood Rose singer Axl Rose. This would lead to Guns N' Roses being formed in March of 1985. That's right, Tracy Guns and Axl Rose merged into Guns N' Roses. So we had Axl Rose, Izzy Stradlin, Tracy Guns, a drummer named Rod Garner, and some bass player named I don't know what, because he didn't stay around for very long. So after they got rid of the other bass player, Duff McKagan was brought in. Duff was in a band called Road Crew. I think that was their name. Something like that. They weren't very popular or famous. Well, they started doing a few little EPs and recording some stuff. But however, Axl Rose and Tracy Guns got into an argument. And Tracy Guns quit to go back to LA Guns. Go figure. Axl Rose getting into an argument with somebody. If you don't know much about Axl, he had a temper in those days. He's kind of mellowed out now, but they would be needing a new guitar player. So Duff suggested his former bandmate, Slash. And actually, I think Slash played in Hollywood Rose at one point. So in comes Slash. Steven Adler would soon join because Garner would quit, the drummer. And there we have the classic band, 1985. Steven Adler on drums. Axl Rose on vocals. Slash on lead guitar, Duff McKagan on the bass, and my favorite, Izzy Stradlin on the rhythm guitar, and a lot of the songwriting. Sort of the heart of the band, Mr. Izzy Stradlin. He was the heart of that entire band, and after he left, it was never the same. Well, let's go back to the LA club scene. They were playing the Troubadour and the Roxy, and they started drawing the attention of some major record labels. They would end up signing in March of 1986 with Geffen Records, and they received $7,500. That was it for a signing bonus. They turned down an offer from some other labels because they wanted them to change their image and sound. David Geffen, the famous record producer, gave them full artistic freedom. They could be Guns N' Roses with Geffen Records. So in December of 1986, they released a four-song EP called Live Like a Suicide. It was designed to give the band keep the band alive while the group was in the studio and had to withdraw from the club scene. So the EP consisted of a couple cover songs, including Rose Tattoo's Nice Boys and Aerosmith's Mama's Kin, which is a really good version of that song. Live Like a Suicide would later be re-released, but it was only limited to 10,000 vinyl copies, I believe it was originally, but they would re-release it in 1988 along with the Lies EP. So trying to get a producer, they went through a lot of people. Actually, Nazareth's guitar player, Paul Stanley of Kiss were all considered. Mutt Lange, who produced a lot of the Def Leppard stuff, and Tom Werman, who did, I believe it was Smoking in the Boys Room for Motley Crue. And ultimately, they settled on Mike Klink, who produced several Triumph records, did a lot of work with UFO in the 70s, actually recorded, not recorded, but he produced a lot of their records. Strangers in the Night. He did that. That was sort of the first real big live album. So Mike Klink was in, and the band entered the Daryl Dragons Ramblin' Rumbo, whatever it was, recording studio to record the debut album. The first 2 weeks, they did basic tracks and a month of overdubs. The drums were done in 6 days, but Axl's vocals took a lot more time because he wanted to do them one song at a time. So that is the beginnings of Appetite for Destruction. We've covered the members of the band. Let's go through how this thing came about. It debuted and was released in July 21st of 1987. I remember Appetite for Destruction because I bought it pretty early because they were playing Welcome to the Jungle on MTV's Headbangers Ball back then. And it was a catchy song. Now, the video is a little weird because Axl has some frizzled up hair and they look a little glammy, but that really wasn't their look. I'm guessing they were just trying to fit in at the time. They would soon go to their straight leather and blue jeans and basically street thug look after that. Of course, Slash always had his top hat on, which is still his trademark to the very day. So the artwork was sort of controversial because the original design and the cover was done by a painter named Robert Williams. It depicted a kind of a dagger-toothed monster that looked like he was trying to go around raping people or something. It was deemed too controversial for 1987. So Axl said that originally he wanted to put the space shuttle Challenger blowing up on the cover, but David Giffen himself rejected that. So they actually took one of Axl Rose's tattoos and put that on the cover, featuring the five band members laying on a cross in skeleton form. And they all, you could tell right away who they were. I mean, Axl's got his headband on and Slash has his hat on. And the only one who didn't have anything on was Steven Adler, who at the time appeared to be the most normal member of the band, at least normal looking. But we would learn that he was the biggest drug addict of them all and would eventually get fired. Sucks to be fired from Guns N' Roses for, I guess, being too drugged out for the band. So let's cover the track list on this thing. I really don't even need to look this up. I know it by heart. We're going to do it in CD form because CDs were the rule in 87. Brett can have his records. And talking to Brett, he said he doesn't like Guns N' Roses and he hates Axl's voice. So to Brett. Track one, Welcome to the Jungle. This would become the first single and the first video, at least in the United States. They actually released another song in the UK, which we'll talk about later. Again, I remember this video vividly. It was played on MTV's Headbangers Ball a lot. Didn't get any mainstream play at all. We'll talk about that as we go through, too. Track two was It's So Easy, which is a totally different sounding song than anything else on the album because Axl's vocals are a little different. And it was actually co-written by a guy named Wes Darkeen, who was a friend of Axl's, and he may actually do some singing on it. Track three was Night Train. Night Train is just a full-out rock and roll, ballsy 70s song. Love the song. Track four was Out to Get Me. I think that was Axl's paranoia coming out in him. Now, do remember, Izzy Stradlin had a hand in writing every one of these songs. So without Izzy, I don't know how this would have went. Song five was Mr. Brownstone, which is about heroin, straight up heroin addiction. Track six, Paradise City. It would become the number three single released. Very catchy song and actually features a synthesizer, which sort of didn't fit, but it's there anyway. Track seven was My Michelle. Track eight, Think About You. Track nine was Sweet Child of Mine, which was the ballad and would become their only number one single. You're Crazy comes next, which was more of a punk, almost thrash song. It's pretty out there. They actually would record a acoustic version of this for Lies the next year, or actually in 88. Would be 2 years after the album was done. Let's see. We're at track 10 now, which is Anything Goes, which they actually was written with Chris Webber, who was originally in Hollywood Rose. And the last song was Rocket Queen, which was a 6 minute and 13 second long song. So it's one of the longer songs on the album. Let's go over the charts and how this thing evolved. So again, it was released in 1987, but it did not sell. It did not sell good at all. Mainly, it was just, I think Slash actually said he figured that they might sell somewhat what a Motorhead album would sell. You know, being their debut album, maybe a little worse, maybe a little better. They were not expecting this thing to blow up, and neither was David Geffen. Actually, it was out for a year before it started to sell. They were ready to move on and make another album and just call this, you know, call this quits. But they pursued and kept on, and this would become one of the biggest selling albums of all time. In the United States alone, this thing sold 18 million copies, 18 times platinum. So how did this thing go from 1 year of just basically not even being on the charts? I think it debuted at like 113 originally to being the number one album in the country. Well, it started, Geffen Records contacted MTV and asked them if they would play Welcome to the Jungle on regular MTV at least three nights a week. It took off. It became the most requested song on MTV at the time. And that would be the catalyst for Guns N' Roses' rise, as well as some of the radio stations and some of the satellite stations we had. At the time, we had a satellite station called Z-Rock, which was actually based in Dallas, Texas, and broadcast all over the United States, playing hard rock and metal. So they finally started getting some radio play. And it would actually be Sweet Child of Mine that would be the first blow-up hit. They actually would re-release Welcome to the Jungle. Sweet Child of Mine went all the way to number one. It was massive, massive hit. And I was so confused at the time because I did not think of Guns N' Roses being a commercial band. I honestly thought that them and the band White Lion might have about the same amount of success just based on their look and their sound. I didn't see Guns N' Roses blowing up to being as big as they were. It wasn't on my brain. I just thought they were going to be, like I said, sort of a moderate, you know, rock metal band. So Welcome to the Jungle, which again, a year after it was released originally, came back out, and it would actually, I think they put a whole lot of Rosie on the original single on the back. I don't know if I'm right about that or not, but it would go to number seven on the Billboard charts. So there's our second big single from Appetite. They would later release Paradise City, which would be, I think technically they may have released some of these songs in England as singles, but this would actually be the third single to reach the top 10 on the Billboard charts. And it featured a synthesizer, and it's a catchy song. The video was done as a live live concert video. It's usually performed even up to, since 1988 as their final encore song. So that's sort of the gist of Appetite for Destruction. It started out weak and became huge. And one of the largest, I think it was the top selling debut album of all time for rock and bands. Let's go over the tour just a little bit. So this was a massive tour. It was 18 months in duration. It would find them opening for a lot of bands like Motley Crue and Alice Cooper, Iron Maiden, Aerosmith, and I think they might have played with the Cult. The Cult might have opened for them. I don't remember at the time, at this very moment. They headlined some shows. Typical set list. Basically, they featured all the songs from Appetite for Destruction. And they actually would throw in Mama Ken from Aerosmith and Knocking on Heaven's Door, which was a Bob Dylan cover, which would later be on the Use Your Illusion albums. I think they did Hair of the Dog from Nazareth. They would also record that on the Spaghetti Incident. So pretty typical set list of the album. It was a five-leg tour. I think I saw Guns N' Roses for the first time at the Bronco Bowl in Dallas, Texas. The Bronco Bowl was basically a bowling alley that had a big, huge club in the back, and a lot of the bands came to town. They played the Bronco Bowl. I remember seeing them on the tour. I don't remember the details. It's been since 1988. I remember being very impressed with them live. So I have fond memories of Appetite for Destruction. I remember buying the actual record album first. It's in the room in there. I should have had it, but I wasn't prepared to do this show. Brett kind of asked me at the last minute. It still holds up well. Now, I know Welcome to the Jungle and Sweet Child of Mine have been overplayed a million times, but some of the songs, I still like them. I'll still listen to them to this day. Very fond of Night Train. I like that song a lot. It's one of my favorite Guns N' Roses songs. It's So Easy is also would probably be my second favorite song on the album. That's about what we got for Guns N' Roses Appetite for Destruction. I could go on for hours about this album, but since this is a midweek episode, I'm going to shut up. We'll play some snippets at the end. If you haven't heard this, I don't know where you've been hiding the last 30 years. One little note. They actually had considered putting the song November Rain on Appetite for Destruction, but instead put Sweet Child of Mine. I still find that funny because I don't see how that song would have fit Guns N' Roses in 1988 or 87. Anyway, that's what Axl says. Who knows? Axel's notoriously known as a liar back then and a paranoid schizophrenic, maybe. He's changed over the years. As you know, Guns N' Roses have reunited with Slash and Duff McKagan, and Slash says Axel's like a totally different person and they all get along well. Unfortunately, Izzy did not come back because they said they didn't want to pay him what he wanted, and Steven Adler is brain damaged. Sorry, dude, but you're brain damaged. So that'll do it for this evening's episode. Check us out on social medias. We might be having a sale on merchandise still on our t-shirt page. You can find the link on the group. Just search Evil Never Dies, Evil Ones to join the group on Facebook. Check out our YouTube page and give us some likes and follows and give us some reviews on Apple Podcast as well. We would appreciate it much. And that's it for this evening. I'm Carl Todd, and stay evil, folks. We will see you on Sunday night.
I've been loaded like a freight train, flying like an aeroplane, feeling like a space brain one more time tonight. I'm on the night train, follow the stars. I'm on the night train, fill my car. I'm on the night train, ready to crash and burn. I never learn. I'm on the night train. I love that star. I'm on the night train, and I can never get enough. I'm on the night train, never to return. No.
Bye.